hosted at missioalliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours. This is Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Because good theology should be for everyone, it's Seminary Dropout. Let's go. My guest today is Brad Lominick. Brad is a strategic advisor and leadership consultant specializing in influence, innovation, generational issues, and business strategy. He's a sought-after speaker at conferences, churches, and colleges, as well as author of The Catalyst Leader. For over a decade, he served as lead visionary and president of Catalyst, one of America's largest movements of Christian leaders. Under his watch, Catalyst convened hundreds of thousands of influencers through high-energy and experiential leadership conferences across the United States. Before running Catalyst, he spent 5 years involved in the growth of the nationally acclaimed Life at Work magazine and was a management consultant with Cornerstone Group. Before that, he served as a foreman for Lost Valley Ranch, a four-diamond working guest ranch in the mountains of Colorado. Brad serves as the advisory board for Suffering Enough, the A21 campaign, Red Eye Inc., and Praxis. Brad, thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me, Shane. Man, I feel like I got a lot to live up to after hearing that. You made it sound so official.
Well, I was going to ask how being the foreman of Lost Valley Ranch prepared you to run like the most preeminent Christian leadership conference
in
the world.
Well, I think it had a lot to do with the amount of horse manure I scoop. Let's just start there, right? I mean, I feel like those things really connect well. That's one of my favorite parts of the bio reading is thinking back to those days of working at Lost Valley Ranch in my 20s.
Well, let's talk about Catalyst real quick. I mentioned it really was kind of the preeminent conference for Christian leadership. I can't imagine just the logistics that involved and the energy that must have required.
Yeah. You know, when we started Catalyst, I mean, I was connected to it. I wasn't leading it in the early days. I was part of it. And then I jumped in a couple of years into it to start to lead it. And I think for all of us, we were, you know, in many ways, we were the substitute teacher, kind of one chapter ahead of the students. And we figured it out as we went. I mean, some of us had some event experience, and a lot of us had worked with John Maxwell up to that point, doing events for John and helping build his organization. But we really wanted it to feel like it was unique and it was authentic and it was really done well, but it had a community essence to it. And this was 2000. And first of all, you know, doing something that was geared towards younger leaders, there wasn't a lot out there that was doing that. And creating something that was high energy, high experiential, that was really outside the box, there wasn't a lot of that. And so a lot of places we were trying to create a new standard for a standard that didn't exist. And, you know, it was interesting to sort of go through that process of being, I wouldn't say we were innovators. I mean, we tried to be innovative, but we always kind of felt like we were out on the end of the diving board and looking at down going, oh gosh, is that shallow right there? Or are we going to hit bottom? Or are we going to actually be able to jump in? And, you know, it forced us really, I think, in many ways on our knees. And we were, because again, we were young and incredibly adventurous and ambitious, but we didn't know a lot, and we had to rely on God to give us wisdom beyond our years. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, movements like Catalyst, or there's other movements, especially in the Christian world, if I start taking credit, or if our team starts taking credit for something like that, then we're just totally at odds with anything that looks like Christian history and or appropriate posture of our role in the story. You know, God breathed on it for a season and still is. And that's so much of our success is a God-breathed movement. And if people start thinking they're creating their own movements, you know, that movement's probably already on its way out.
The beginning of the end.
Yeah.
I
don't know if that answered your question.
That's perfect.
I went a little bit of a different direction.
I think it must be, there must be a strange pressure to essentially you're gathered around by some of the most amazing living leaders in the world, and then have to essentially in that aspect be their leaders for a while as you organize that conference while that conference is going on. I mean, that would be, it seems like an environment where it would be hard to fake it and to mail it in.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. I mean, I always felt like I still to this day, I mean, this is not a humble brag. I look around and go, wow, like I hope nobody finds out. Not the real story in the sense of, you know, I'm hiding something, but more of, gosh, like I'm being put in places of leadership and opportunity that I have no business being in. And I think that's actually when we think about the leaders, at least for me, the ones I admire and the ones I respect, I think their posture is many times like that, where they never feel like they've arrived. They're always kind of still in that hungry second posture. They walk into the room and act like they don't belong, but they work their guts out to get there, you know, and stay there. But just that sense of, man, I never feel like I've arrived. And for me, that's been true. I mean, every season of my life as a leader, whether it was riding horses or running a ranch, or it was doing consulting, or it was launching a magazine, or it was doing conferences, I've never felt that sense of being the expert, right? I mean, I just never have felt that I've gotten there. And I think that's healthy, at least for me it has been.
I think, you know, in the entrepreneurial world, there's a lot of talk about what they call the imposter syndrome.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that's it. And you, that idea that we feel like we're faking it and we don't belong in this group of real leaders, real innovators. But really, once we peel off that superficial layer, we just kind of realize that that's how life is for everybody.
Yeah. Well, we were always, you know, with Catalyst, we had a lot of people of great influence, not just in the church, but across all spectrums, whether they were designers or, you know, best-selling leadership authors or CEOs or people in the entertainment world, whatever. And what I noticed, again, I mean, just proving your point, like these folks, the higher up the ladder of influence and power they seem to be, the more aware of themselves they were. And they walked in with a lack of entourage, with a lack of like, I'm the big deal, so you need to treat me a certain way. And I just love that. I love when you peel back the layers and you saw, for me anyway, from my seat, I got to see behind the scenes of, okay, what are these people really like without the spotlight on them? And it was one thing for them to be around me, because if I'm running Catalyst, then I've got something of value that they're going to, you know, they're probably going to treat me a certain way. But I would watch them treat, you know, the lower end folks on our team the same way. And I would watch them treat arena people the same way, working at arenas where we'd have events. And I would watch them treat production guys the same way. And it just always proved out that these leaders who had accomplished much were truly just always willing to stoop low, or to the lowest denominator and numerator in the room, to really connect with them. And I think that's why they get to the places they get to.
Well, this book starts with kind of a crash that you had when you were in leadership.
Yeah. Well, I was sitting at a lunch in the fall, early fall, like August of 2013. And I'd just written the Catalyst Leader earlier that spring. I'm 10 years into running Catalyst, or actually at that point, like 12 years into running Catalyst, where everything's up and to the right, successful, the most attendees ever. And I just felt that sense of not burnout, but the sense of slow decay. And I hadn't really talked to anybody about it. And I was sitting at a lunch with a friend, a guy named Steve Cockerman. He just looked at me and he said, "You're done." Like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm done with lunch? I said, "No," he said, "You're done. Like, you're done with this season." And it was like hitting me with a brick in the face. And he said, first of all, you need to take a sabbatical. So let's figure out a way to get you, you know, 3 or 4 months off this fall. And then let's sort of reimagine your leadership and your sense of who you are and your role. And this is not, it wasn't like you're doing a bad job with Catalyst, Brad. You're doing a bad job in your role. Like we're watching things totally implode. It was none of that. It was more looking at me personally and saying, bro, you need some time off, but I want to step in and create some preventive measures before you truly jump off the cliff. And it was such a major moment and mile marker in my leadership journey, because out of that, I took 3 months off, took a sabbatical. You know, I feel like in many ways, I re-identified sort of the important things for my own leadership, but also just recalibrated my own life. And then out of that season, you know, I stepped out of running Catalyst. But the simplicity of this story for me is that it was a kind of a crisis moment, but it wasn't like I had a major moral breakdown. You know, I was stealing money from the company. It wasn't a thing that would have been like reported in the Christian Post or on Relevant or, you know, in Christianity Today. There was none of that. Like, there was no story behind the story. But given my own tendency to be type A, to keep on fighting, to stay in the ring, I would have probably 2 or 3 years later, who knows, maybe today, like I might be sitting here and I would have jumped off the cliff. I mean, I would have had something major happen. I would have crashed in my leadership journey. And I'm just so thankful that there was somebody in my life who said, hey, like you're like the boxer who is in the 14th round and he's not going to bow out. Like he will absolutely pass out before he bows out. And I needed somebody in my life to step in and go, okay, you're done. Time for a break. And I'm going to help you walk through that. So that's, you know, that's that moment I came out of that. And now, you know, 2 years later, really feel so much healthier and lots of things are back in line. And the book really came out of a lot of that season of reimagining and re-envisioning what are the key things for me as it relates to my own leadership that I want to pass on. And that's where the Habits book came and H3 Leadership.
You know, it's important. I don't think I mentioned the name of the book. It's H3 Leadership, and that the H's are be humble, stay hungry, and always hustle. You know, a lot of the humility side of the book that you write about, essentially, they're different for each of those, you know, hungry, humble, hustle are different, or about five principles. Essentially, the principles for humility have to do with authenticity. Mm-hmm. You know, being who you are and who you're created to be. And, you know, some people would say that there's like kind of a disconnect between that and being a good leader. How does being humble, how does being authentic make somebody a good leader?
Well, definitely today, authenticity is required as a leader. And if you're not real, and you're not leading from a place of being authentic and understanding who you truly are, then you're not going to be able to have influence with others. And no generation ever has basically said, we won't follow you unless you're real. You know, the old days of fake it till you make it and hide all the stuff behind the curtain, you know, just put it in the corner. Like nobody will find out. You have a public persona that doesn't match your private internal self. And man, not only are you not going to have influence today, but you're probably going to get found out, because we live in a day where you will get exposed, you know? So the best premise for this in today's leadership culture and the landscape we live in is, man, be real, like live this out. And we see it everywhere. It's the buzzword. Everybody's talking about it. But I just think it's really important, especially as Christian leaders. I mean, we are fighting in many ways against a culture that says that I don't trust you. There's a lot about who you are already showing up that I'm a little bit nervous about. And I don't trust people in charge anymore. So I just think authenticity has to be this currency that you walk in with. And, you know, back to the point of even this, what does it look like to connect that to leadership? The more self-aware you are, and the more you're willing to be okay with mistakes you've made and vulnerabilities you have, and living out transparency, the more people will want to be on your team, and they'll want to be around you. And this is just, you see this everywhere. It's constant. And we just won't, none of us anymore will follow somebody who's a fake. The old days we would put up with it, but it has to be in place today. And so I think it's the place to start. I mean, that's the reason that I started the book there is, if you're truly not self-aware and not in dialed in with who you are, then you gotta get to that point. And most of us, if we're honest, the more we start stewarding, the more influence we have, the more power we get, more authority we create, the more title we have, the further we go up the leadership ladder, the harder it is to stay real. Because all of a sudden we start watching people around us, we start feeling like there's this standard we have to live up to, we start faking it, and you look back and go, what happened to that? What happened to the me that I was 10 years ago? And for me, I mean, Shane, like one of my greatest struggles in the role of leading Catalyst was that I was around people I really admired all the time. I was around people that I really respected, that I wanted to emulate. And the hardest thing for me was to just walk in and be Brad and be the knucklehead kid that grew up in outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, that's a Oklahoma Sooners fan, that rode horses for a while, that, you know, was in a rap group in high school, that is, you know, like, I got to be me. And if I start trying to be Andy Stanley or Bob Goff or Irwin McManus or whoever, Jim Collins, Malcolm Gladwell, like, if I start trying to be those people, then I'm not being the best expression of who I am. And so this has to be something that rises at the top of every leader's to-do list.
And that's a really hard thing not to do when you're around people that you really admire and you want to ingratiate yourself to those people and to not come off as a dummy.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, that's always the temptation is the more I'm around people that I really admire and like, the more I start trying to be like them. And we see it so much, especially in church leadership, because so much of the conversation is around the ability to communicate. And so even we start like communicating and speaking and teaching and preaching like that pastor or that communicator we really like, and we start using their same words and their same phrases, and all of a sudden you're them. And that's just not a good place to be. God has created all of us uniquely to be exactly who he designed us to be. So
it's something also that's very transparent. People can tell when you're faking it, when you're not being authentic.
Oh gosh, big time. Especially your team. I mean, those closest to you who know you the best should be calling you out the most. And because they know, like they see that. And part of your job as a leader to be authentic is to give them permission to, you know, and that's, again, that's hard. That's a hard thing. Once you start climbing up the ladder of power and influence is surrounding yourself with people who will absolutely get in your grill. I call them my grill club, and it's the people in my life who will speak truth into me constantly. And I don't want them to just come around me and tell me what I want to hear. I want them to come around me and tell me what I need to hear. And most of us, again, the further we get up the ladder, the further we get away from real life, from reality. I call it reality deprivation syndrome. But a lot of leaders suffer from this, and they start just distancing themselves from reality. And you look at them and go, seriously, how can you be so disconnected from what's true? And the reason is because they've surrounded themselves with people who are only telling them what they want to hear.
You know, I was thinking, if you wrote a book about how to be a horrible leader, you could also call it humble, hungry, hustle. Like there's a dark side to each of those things.
Yes. Yeah.
That's not really something that I read in the book, but it occurred to me as I was reading it that there's a dark side to each one of those. Even being humble, there's a point at which that turns into self-abuse.
Yes.
And lack of self-care.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And even the aw shucks, you know, like the...
Yeah, fake modesty, yeah.
You got it. Like, yeah, the, oh, well, you know, I'm really, really not that... Aw shucks, I'm really not that good. And I think it's a confident humility, a posture that says, I'm confident in the way I've been wired and who I am and my gifts, but I'm willing to realize that I'm not the center of the story. Mm. And that there's a bigger story happening here, and I'm a piece of the story, and I'm going to play my part. But it's not about me. I mean, I think at the end of the day, humility. So much of humility is. I mean, we've heard this statement so often. You know, humility is not thinking of less of yourself. It's just thinking of yourself less, mm-hmm. and it's putting others and the putting other people at the forefront. I mean, I love the idea for me, like my own posture of humility. At least one of those ways I've tried to live out being a humble leader is that I've always tried to build a platform that other people could stand on. Hmm. And people would say, they would ask me over the years of Catalyst, like, you know, why don't you speak? Why don't you get up on stage a lot more? You know, what's your desire here in leading this thing, but not being the center of it? I said, well, I just feel like my calling is to build a platform that I can put other people up on and I can elevate them. And I'm not lowering myself. That's the key. Like I'm not aw shucksing myself. I'm just saying, man, I want to create an environment and a gathering where people can stand up on that stage and I can elevate what they're doing. And, you know, so that's practically the way I try to live out humility. But, you know, for all of us, you're exactly right. There is a very quick, or a very thin line between the good and the bad side of each of these buckets. And, for that matter, for each of the habits that go with them, there's a thin line between the, you know, the good and bad side. And that's true for leadership. If leadership is truly influence, the gang leader is just as talented in influencing people. They just decided that influence would be used in a way that is negative, you know, or for that matter, take historical figures, you know, Hitler.
Right.
And Hitler is an incredibly influential guy. So you could argue one of the greatest leaders of all time. You right. just use it in the wrong way. But if leadership is influence, he was really influential.
Yeah, and you can say that he was hungry and had hustle as well.
Oh, no question, yeah. I don't know about the humility part, but I mean, definitely hungry and hustle. He's
right.
living that out.
Yeah, that's right. And you can, you know, I think we can all identify people who have a win at all costs mentality. And it seems like those leaders that I really look up to say, no, look, we're going to win, but we're going to do it inside these boundaries, these ethical boundaries, these moral boundaries, these boundaries that don't railroad people in the process.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, with this H3 equation, I know a lot of leaders who are incredibly humble that absolutely do nothing. So they have tons of humility. They realize it's not about them, but they have no hustle whatsoever. Hmm. And I know a lot of leaders who hustle that have no humility.
Right.
And they run over people, and it is all about them, and it's all about them gaining, and it's all about them building their own kingdom, and it's geared towards, you know, their success. So these three legs of the stool have to be balanced. And I think that's really important. You know, people will ask, hey, which of these is the most important? Like, well, they're all important.
Yeah.
You gotta really live all of them out in order to be an effective leader. This is a cumulative report card. You can't just be an A in humility and an F in hustle.
they're not hierarchical.
You got it. Yeah, exactly right.
Talk a little bit about habits and the role that habits play in leadership.
Well, you know, I love the Power of Habit book that Charles Duhigg wrote a couple of years ago. Yellow cover, really, really good book. Highly recommend it. And, you know, his was more around sort of personal life and talking about the power of habit and how habit is so important in our lives and how we don't even realize it. And I thought, that's interesting. I'd love to take a stab maybe at what does habits look like for me in my own leadership journey. And so these 20 habits emerged. And I'm sure there's more than 20. These aren't the only 20 habits around leadership. They just seem to make the most sense for the the context and the framework of this book. But I hope what I'm trying to get to is, here's 20 practical ways for you to create habits that will not only like fuel your leadership journey, but will sustain it. And we all know that leadership's hard. Anybody who leads realizes that it's difficult because you're leading people, and people are difficult. And especially, you know, more people. The more people you're leading, the harder it is. And anything hard in life, whether it's quitting smoking, whether it's losing weight, whether it's being a better father, whether it's, you know, like trying to serve your spouse, whatever it is, like the harder things in life require habits to be put in place. Otherwise, you just won't make it happen. I mean, we all watch every year, you know, friends who say, okay, I'm going to lose that 20 pounds this year, and they don't make it happen. And part of that is because they didn't put behaviors in place that turned into habits that then sustain them over time. And so that's the idea behind this is, man, are there some habits that I can put in place that will help me finish the race well? And the practical part of those hopefully comes out in the book that, you know, this has been lived out. I've seen it in myself, and I've seen it in others. You know, the beauty of habits too is that once a habit's in place, then a lot of times it becomes unconscious. And so it becomes part of our normal framework. And you just have to get over the barrier of getting to the place where it becomes sustainable. And then once it's sustainable, then it's much easier to continue to make sure that it's happening on a consistent basis.
One of the things that I really like about the book is that it was so applicable in a universal way. I've read a number of business books, and there are a lot of them that, you know, you get done with that chapter on like business acquisitions and think, well, that's, I guess I'll remember that if I ever acquire a business, but
right.
Probably not gonna happen, you know, for me as a podcaster. But it was all like every bit of it was extremely applicable. And I wonder if that was something that you thought about and were conscious about as you were writing the book.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I want to read books that are practical and, like you said, universal, that everyone, I mean, you obviously have to have a really narrow focused target when you write something, as you know, I mean, as a writer, like if you're writing to everyone, then you're writing to no one. But I wanted it to feel like there was a sense of, man, this is going to be practical and be able to put into practice today. And that was the question I continued to ask and wrestle with every chapter was, can somebody actually do this? Or is this just behind the sky, hope of land? Because
sure.
I've read enough of those. And I don't like those books. And I really don't want to be that guy who just adds to that stack of here's another book that seems like a good idea, but I'm never going to actually put anything into my life that will become consistent. So yes, it was a huge part of the thinking. And, you know, even the bullet points, I think there's probably 150 bullet points of practical sort of next steps. Now, given to my own motivation, Shane, like I'm a list guy. So I, you know, my publisher kept having to say, Brad, less bullet points. Seriously, you're killing us with the bullet points.
I'm surprised the publisher would say that, honestly.
Well, they, you know, they're wanting a little bit more of a story arc, and I get that. Like, that's a good part of writing a book is that you have to take people on a journey.
Sure.
But I'm just the kind of guy, I'm so logical in my thinking that I would just write a leadership book with 400 bullet points and just say, guys, like, do all these 400 things and you're golden. So I had to kind of back off the list making and make it a little bit more of a story arc.
Well, speaking of that, the book's full of stories about leaders that you've gotten to know that taught you something along the way, that the way, you know, not necessarily sitting you down saying, hey, Brad, here's a lesson, but you saw something the way they did something.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could just share a couple of stories like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the most memorable for me, you know, is a guy that most people wouldn't know that when I worked at Lost Valley Ranch when I was in my 20s, just after college, a guy named Bob Foster. And he was 75 and I was 25. And he would say to me constantly, he mentored me and he was this old wise man. And he would say, Brad, your 20s, establish your 70s. Your 20s, the man or woman of God you want to become, for all of us, the man or woman of God we want to become when we're 75 is all based on the man or woman of God we're becoming when we're 25. And that really shook me. I mean, because so many of us, when we're young, we don't think about legacy. We're not thinking about the finish line. We're thinking about the starting line. But if we have that premise that, you know, that the finish line has to be in front of us on a consistent basis, that the way we finish is all based on the way we start. That was a huge one. John Maxwell, really, for me, so many ways, he modeled good leadership. I think one of the things that he did that even now practically helps me so much is his curiosity, his insatiable appetite to learn. And people always would say, ask John, like, you know, how can you write so many books? Like, how do you come up with all this stuff? And they never saw behind the scenes where I would watch John. He was constantly writing. He was constantly aggregating content and information from people. So anytime he was in front of someone, whether they were, you know, a president or whether they were some bellman at a hotel, he was curious and he was always learning and he was always capturing something from these conversations. And the guy he would have tons of news articles and press clippings and quotes and all this stuff that, because of his curiosity, that would end up being aggregated into these files that Linda, his assistant, would somehow create this filing system, which was, you know, I think it's even better than like the Dewey Decimal system. but John had he had cabinets and cabinets of all these things that he had written down over the years. And so that's the reason he could go and write a book and multiple books. And, you know, every year he could write a book because he was so curious and was always learning. And I think a lot of us, you know, we feel like that our role as leaders should be to be talking all the time. And I just learned from John, like the greatest way for you and many times is to gain power or authority in a conversation is to ask great questions. When you ask great questions, you immediately sort of take command of that moment. And especially for young leaders, a lot of us, you know, we feel like, oh, I've got to like have a great answer. No, you have a great question. You walk in with a great question and you automatically will elevate yourself and gain credibility with whoever you're talking to. Those are a few.
I found it so interesting, Brad, that you use the examples you use were John Maxwell, who is like arguably the most well-known leadership thought leader around. And then you use your boss at the ranch that nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
I find that leadership is more often quiet and hidden than otherwise. That
yes.
There you find them in the most unlikely places.
Especially those that tend to know the most. Right? I mean, I think I'm always nervous around somebody who feels like they have to say a lot. And that's in lots of different settings. But it's like the guys in high school, at least for me, like the guys in high school I was most scared of were the ones who were really quiet. You know, the bullies were the ones who talked all the time and, you know, it's like, come on, man. But the quiet ones were the ones that you sort of had to watch out for. And I think that's true in like you're saying, a lot of the people we admire the most are the ones who say the most. And I just think some of us should change our posture where we're listening the most. And those who listen the most and are quiet, confident and quiet tend to have the most to say, I think, that is actually impactful.
You know, this week I just published my interview with Allie Worthington, who just published a book about being busy, breaking busy. Your book and hers, you know, it's in that category of things that people need not be Christians to read it and benefit from it. You know, it's not like a theology book or something like that. But it also begs the question, what difference for you does Jesus make in this subject, in this area of your life?
Well, I mean, it's a huge difference for me personally, and everything that I am, and sort of my who I am DNA wise is because of my walk with Jesus. And I, you know, I think one of the things I'm trying to do as even an author, and in the way that I approach my conversations and culture, and even the way we did Catalyst over the years, like we were very upfront and expressive and willing to walk in with sort of our Jesus jersey on. At the same time, we wanted to also walk in with that sense of excellence and that sense of, man, we're the best in the world at what we do. And we're going to be able to walk into cultural conversations and sit at the table. And we're going to be willing to like walk in with that because it's who we are. And it then allows us to sort of show up with an understanding that we're not trying, we don't have an agenda here. This is just who we are. And, you know, so I think so many people, especially in the Christian world, and you and I could probably talk about this for hours, the idea that does it have to be Christian in order to be Christian, in the sense does it have to like, you know, spell that out in order for the principles of following Jesus to emerge from the pages. And I just think that so many times we feel like we've got to sort of we've got to stamp everything with whatever the Christian stamp is, compared to walking in and going, man, we love Jesus, but we're going to show up and be the best in the world at what we do. And those who follow Jesus will see that, and those who don't follow Jesus will be attracted to it. I feel like for me, I just have more conversations, even now with this book, you know, because the book is. You're right. I mean, it's applicable to anybody. I'm trying much more for this to be a book for leaders at every level. In every stage, sort of in their own journey of faith. But I've found that I've had a lot of conversations with non-Christians around this book who say, "Brad, thank you for writing something that's really smart, but it also is not you hiding your faith. But you're also not slapping me in the face with it." And, you know, I've watched Maxwell. Maxwell's a great example. Dave Ramsey is a great example. There's a lot of great examples today of people who are the best at what they do. Mark Burnett, I mean, he did the foreword on the book, the producer of The Voice. Like, there's these people who, for me, have just been a good example of walk in to the middle of the conversation, don't hide who you are, but don't feel like you have to, like, stamp it all the time.
And I think most of us know that somewhat intuitively. I mean, you know, I shared with you before we started recording, you know, my day job's in real estate. The way that I honor God in that is to be the best real estate agent I can be.
Yes.
That doesn't look like leading my clients in a Bible study before we go look at houses or something like that. That's how I honor God in that. And most of the people listening right now don't have church jobs. They've got some kind of secular vocation. And that they understand that they glorify God in that in a very specific way.
Absolutely, man. And I will stand on that soapbox all day long, especially for those of us who do, like you're saying, you know, we don't necessarily operate in a full-time ministry, church staff, missionary. And I grew up with that dichotomy. I mean, I grew up thinking that if I didn't do that, then I was a second-class citizen in the kingdom of God. And I that's not true. That's a false statement that somehow we've been relegated to the JV team in the kingdom because we're walking into a different environment. And like you said, Shane, we're not doing Bible studies, but we're doing our work with excellence. And we're the frontline workers, though, that have the greatest ability to draw people to Jesus way more than a pastor. I mean, I hear my pastor, Louis Giglio, say all the time, Louis will say to us as a congregation, listen, you should and will have way more opportunities to to express Jesus to your friends than I will ever be able to your friends. Because as soon as they find out I'm a pastor, the walls go up. But man, you guys are walking into environments and they're willing to have conversations. We end up feeling like we gotta know everything, and we gotta, like, you know, get our multiple Bible study curriculums out and throw them down on the desk. And that may be true sometimes, but the best way, I think, as you said, for us to really, like, prove the gospel to be true is for us to do what we do so well that people ask why.
Well, the last thing I want to ask you, Brad, is, you know, we talked a little bit about just the universality of this book. And, you know, there probably are some leaders of big organizations listening to this, but there's tons more, I can guarantee, people just like me who are just a one-person operation. And I'm curious to know if there's any specific advice or word from you to people like me.
Well, the first thing is this. I think faithfulness is such a huge part of the equation. And, you know, there's a point for all of us when we've been trying to get the flywheel going, you know, whether in starting something new, or somebody listening may be in that place where they've been, you know, they're in a role that they don't feel like is their dream job. They're 27, they're 28, they feel like they're kind of stuck, and they look at the horizon of the future and go, that's where I want to be. And how do I deal with the now? And, you know, I think I just would remind people, I said this earlier, you know, that idea of being at Lost Valley Ranch. And for me, I was 25 and I was scooping manure. I mean, truly, like, that's what I was doing. I was dealing with a lot of manure, and God was reminding me at 25, like, Brad, there may be things that I have for you in the future, but right now I want to see you be faithful to being a pooper scooper, you know. And there was more to the job than that, but that's true. Like, our assignment, our current assignment, and the faithfulness to which we do that assignment and as the best we can do it, and we lead well within that current assignment, is our scorecard in the kingdom. And, you know, that's good news, because it all of a sudden changes the paradigm from what happens if I never lead something big. You know, like, for me, Shane, like, one of the biggest challenges for me in stepping away from Catalyst was, okay, first of all, is anybody still going to want to hang out with you? Like, when you're Catalyst, you're not the Catalyst guy anymore. So now does, like, do all those people still want to be your friend? But then secondly, what does it look like to go from leading thousands to now potentially only, or influencing thousands to now potentially influencing tens? And am I okay with that assignment for this season? And I had to wrestle with that and go, you know what? I got to be faithful to this season. If I'm influencing 10 people, I want to be the best at that current assignment as I can possibly be. And that faithfulness is the measure of my success in God's kingdom, the scorecard. You know, it's the parable of the talents. And I know that's been true for me. And so hopefully that's encouraging to somebody. Just, they're sensing, I don't feel like I'm in the place I want to be, but I would just say, like, be faithful. Take that assignment and do it really well.
It seems like, too, those times when we're doing those jobs that aren't glamorous in the least, that really kind of lays the groundwork for being a humble leader when we are given positions of leadership.
Yes. Gosh, such a great point. Yeah. I mean, I think the reason, and I don't know this to be true, I'll find out, you know, in eternity, but I think the reason that I could shoulder the stewardship of Catalyst was because I was shouldering the stewardship of scooping manure at 25 in Colorado in the middle of the mountains, thinking, what are you doing? You should be, like, interning for a senator in Oklahoma. Instead, you're scooping poop, you know. And that the dark places, as Christine Kane says, you know, the dark room, the places where you are formed in the dark days, the shadows of your life, the place when nobody sees you, when nobody's paying attention, that gives you the platform to stand on and the foundation to be able to then deal with the spotlight. And so many of us want the spotlight before we want the dark room. But we got to go in the dark room first in order many times or most of the time to get to the place where we get to the spotlight. But the spotlight may never come. And that's the other side of the equation is you may never see the spotlight, but that doesn't mean you haven't succeeded in your journey.
Spotlight can't be the goal.
You got that right. Yes, exactly right.
Well, Brad, it's been so good talking with you, and thanks so much for being on Seminary Dropout.
I loved it, man. Thanks for having me, and man, love what you're doing. Keep it up. Keep inspiring people, and hopefully there was one bit of good nugget in here somewhere that somebody can take and put into practice.
I think there's probably more than one, but thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,